You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 1st of February, 2013, here on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House here on Monocle 24, coming to you live from Studio One here in London with me, Tyler Brûlé. Coming up over the next 60 minutes, we'll head to the Munich Security Conference and get the highlights from day one, according to Oxford Analytica CEO Nader Moussavizadeh. Then we'll speak to Murdo Morris in a Flight International magazine about how too much automation in aviation can actually contravene safety. And we'll be getting the latest on the ongoing protests in Egypt.
If we put Mubarak in jail now because we had some people that were killed 2 years ago, for me, Morsi did exactly the same thing. And for me, Morsi has to be beside Mubarak in jail, not president of Egypt.
We'll also take a look at Libya's new banknotes, get a roundup of this week's news headlines, and meet a neighbor of our Zurich bureau, the pie shop.
The favorites are the chicken pie and the shepherd's pie. We also have a beef and Guinness pie, and we do a special pie for the locals, which is called a Zürich pie. That's, of course, with veal, mushrooms, and potatoes.
Yum. All that to come over the next hour here on Midori House. So a lot to get through over the next 59 minutes, which means we should probably head over to Bilbingham with the news headlines.
Monocle 24 News. A suicide bomber has attacked the US embassy in the Turkish capital Ankara, killing one of the guards. The blast at a side entrance of the heavily guarded compound sent debris flying onto the street. No one has claimed responsibility for the attack, but officials say the bomber, who also died, was a far-left militant and may have been a member of the outlawed Revolutionary People's Liberation Party Front. It's also believed the attacker was a Turkish national. US Ambassador Francis Ricciardone paid tribute to the Turkish guard who was killed in the blast.
Right now we are all dealing with our sadness at the loss of our fellow member of our embassy. We salute his bravery, his service to Turkey and to Turkish-American friendship. Our hearts go out to his family.
Rescue workers are continuing to dig for survivors after an explosion ripped through several floors of a skyscraper in Mexico City. The explosion at the headquarters of the Mexican oil company Pemex killed 32 people, 20 women and 12 men. More than 120 people have been injured. The blast blew out windows and damaged three floors of the 51-story building in Mexico City's commercial center. Thousands of opponents of Egyptian President Mohamed Morsi are staging new protests after the deadliest week of violence since he came to power. More than 60 people have been killed in the unrest. On Thursday, leaders of some of the main political factions condemned the violence, but youth groups later called for more street demonstrations. Germany's Foreign Minister Guido Westerwelle has confirmed he's to meet his Iranian counterpart Ali Akbar Salehi in Munich to discuss Iran's nuclear program. Herr Westerwelle made the announcement after a meeting with EU Foreign Policy Chief Baroness Catherine Ashton in Berlin. He said the two ministers will also discuss recent proposals by the US administration for direct talks between Washington and Tehran. A toxic cloud of smog has enveloped India's capital, New Delhi, sending air pollution levels even higher than those being recorded in Beijing. Visibility is poor, and vehicles have been crawling on the streets with their headlights on. Most flights in and out of the city have been delayed, and several trains have had to be rescheduled. Scientists say Delhi has pollution levels considered hazardous against the World Health Organization's recommended daily particulate material, or PM, level of not more than 20. Anumita Roy Chowdhury from the Centre for Science and Research says something needs to be done quickly to avoid serious respiratory ailments.
If you look at the pollution levels that are getting recorded by the automatic monitors in the city, it shows very clearly that the levels are several times higher than the standards. PM2.5 level, I'm told, has recorded nearly more than 200 up to 300 microgram per cubic meter, and these are extremely tiny particles that go very deep inside your lung.
New York Mayor Michael Bloomberg has been speaking fondly about former Mayor Ed Koch, who's died at the age of 88. Mr. Koch died of congestive heart failure at the New York Presbyterian Hospital following a year of repeated hospital treatment. Speaking at an event marking the 100th anniversary of the building of New York's Grand Central Rail Terminal, Mayor Bloomberg praised Ed Koch's achievements.
I have enormous respect and admiration for what Ed was able to accomplish during some of the city's toughest times and for the integrity he brought to the job and to every part of his life. And when we mourn his passing, Ed really, we always say this, but Ed really would have wanted us to celebrate his life and the life of the city he loved.
That's the latest news on Monocle 24.
Thanks very much for that, Bill. More from you in 25 minutes at the bottom of the hour. It is 19:05 in Munich, where we're heading to in a moment, 18:05 here in London. You are listening to Midori House. Back after this. Well, today was the first of the three-day Munich Security Conference, now in its 49th year. In attendance are heads of state, defense ministers, Nobel Peace Prize laureates, military leaders, CEOs, and analysts, all there to discuss everything from the future of the EU to the conflicts in Syria and Mali. To get the day's highlights, we'll turn to Nader Moussavizadeh, CEO of London-based global analysis and advisory firm Oxford Analytica. Nader is at the conference. Good evening.
Good evening, Tyler.
It's quite a shopping list, a variety of various keynotes to look at. The euro crisis and the future of the EU, the American oil and gas bonanza, Syria, Mali, as we were saying in the intro, the rising powers and global governance. What caught your eye today, Nader?
Well, I think a couple of things, Tyler. One is that as the agenda is crowded, so is the room. It has become really a meeting that is attracting more and more people from various both walks of life, geographies, businesses, and governments. And it's become really a conference that brings together a whole range of security issues in a pretty good conversation. Today, the main session was really, well, there were two. One was on Europe, but one that was more closely aligned with the security focus of the conference was the future energy picture. What is the implication of the U.S. oil and gas bonanza, particularly the shale bit? What does it mean for geopolitics? What does it mean for global security? That has been a major focus of the day today.
You almost answered my question, because probably question three was going to be just the role of the Munich Security Conference. It does seem to have moved up the global agenda, probably over the last 3 years, that it was something quite niche of the world of Janes and something that you'd maybe read in sort of think tank reports, but it wasn't really sort of part of the daily news agenda. What's changed?
Well, I think what's changed is the, first of all, the ability of Wolfgang Ischinger, the chairman of the conference, and the people around it, the team around him, to change with changing times. So I think that's one important dimension of this. The second really is, if you think about these last 10 years, the wars of 9/11, the degree to which so much of Western foreign policy has become militarized. Both, I think, an interesting question, but also a serious challenge if you think about the diplomatic work that has suffered in relation to that. But given the strong emphasis on military dimensions, whether it's been the wars of Iraq and Afghanistan, whether it's the whole special forces drones element of this, there really is as tight as ever an intersection between military security, financial security, human security, and that's what makes this conference, I think, as interesting as it is today.
I'm wondering, when one sits in on these sessions, and let's take the American oil and gas bonanza, the changing geopolitics of energy, does it always come down to, do they try to wrap it up on a security note and make sure that they are talking to the assembled defense ministers, foreign ministers who are in the room?
No, I think today it was very striking that there was a significant discussion of what this means for the changing energy picture, with the environmental dimensions of it, what it means for the Gulf, what it means for the economies of the Gulf of West Africa, and certainly obviously what this long-term impact is going to be on U.S. competitiveness. And what does that mean for manufacturing in the United States, and how does that rebalance the U.S.-China relationship? All those dimensions were brought in. So to answer your question, it was not an exercise really in bringing it just to the security and defense dimension.
Looking at everything that's on this agenda, as I said, it is pretty... on one side, it's very broad, and it is quite dense. What's of most interest to you, though, over the coming days?
Well, I think, you know, one of the dimensions that's interesting, you know, with this, the time that we're going to spend on Mali and what's happening broadly in the Sahel, is a reminder of the unpredictability of a lot of global security issues. Right? No one was thinking about Mali a year ago, certainly not in this kind of context. So I think that's one dimension of it. There's going to be a very good and long session on Iran on the last day, which I think everyone knows is just lying right beneath the surface as the major security geopolitical challenge of this year. And I think a lot of the questions people are going to be asking themselves is, in the second Obama administration, John Kerry starting as Secretary of State, will the U.S. take a more proactive diplomatic approach to this with more investment, really, both by the President and the Secretary of State in the kind of hand-to-hand combat of diplomatic negotiations, as opposed to some of the other public diplomacy and other kind of emphases we've seen in the last 4 years.
One interesting thing when you look at the delegate list, Nader, for example, many commented at Davos that China really wasn't present, given all of the discussion about China, etc., that you really sort of didn't feel China in the room. But if I look at, you know, various sessions there, you know, for example, Song Tao, the Vice Minister of Foreign Affairs for China, is in attendance, and various other names as well. I'm wondering, what is it about also this security conference? Again, is it the focus that the Chinese maybe feel more comfortable in that environment?
Well, I would say a few things. One is, first of all, we have the chairman of CIC in the Europe session talking very interestingly about how China thinks about manufacturing, how it thinks about exports, how it thinks about high-end manufacturing, comparing itself to Germany in lots of ways. So that's one certainly Chinese perspective we had. I think the second is, truthfully, there aren't many Chinese, either from the security side or the business side. And what this, I think, speaks to as well is, as you know, Tyler, what China's going through right now, both in terms of the transition of the leadership, but also increasingly inward is the new outward at this point in Chinese history. There's going to be an enormous focus of the leadership on managing a lot of internal issues, even as they obviously can't turn away from the world. And I think that might be reflected in the relative absence of Chinese representatives today.
For all of the delegates in attendance, so if I was a defense minister from Belgium or if I was from Norway, for example, how much do the big players have input into the various themes and discussions? I'm looking at something tomorrow, pooling and sharing, which is not about getting kids to school. It's but what the future of European defense. And of course, we hear about airlift capacity, sea lift capacity, how, of course, NATO countries, they have been banding together. Maybe they'll have to do so more in the future. Is that something where, you know, Brussels is and the Secretary General's office saying, this is something we'd like to get out in the open, and this is a great topic for Munich?
Well, I think that is one of the things that distinguishes Munich, which is that it has had a long, long-standing relationship as an institution, both with governments, large defense establishments, and companies. And so that actually brings a kind of relevance to the discussions that might not otherwise be there. But I would say that very much the agenda is balanced between what you would think governments or large defense contractors would want to make sure is discussed by way of subjects with, you know, other kinds of issues that are more general and more speculative, rise of the new powers in global governance. There's a nightcap called From Telephone to Twitter, Diplomacy in a Digital Age. I mean, there are other ways in which I think they're trying to broaden both the definition of security, but also the numbers of voices that they want to have heard.
And I have to note that happens at 10:30 tomorrow night, Diplomacy in a Digital Age, in the nightclub at the Bayerischer Hof. I'm sure you'll be there, right, Nader?
I definitely will.
We'll probably check in again with you next week. Nader Moussavizadeh, the CEO of Oxford Analytica at the Munich Security Conference there. You are listening to Midori House in London. It's just 14 minutes past the hour.
Ambitious architects, best-in-show builders, concrete connoisseurs, density designers, energy evangelists, friendly foxes, guerrilla gardeners, high-minded historians, inspirational investors, jaded janitors, Kmart killjoys, low-rise lovers, mighty mayors, naughty nocturnalists, office block occupiers, plotting planners, quietness questers, rebels and reactionaries, spick-and-span street sweepers, transport theorists, urbane urbanists, visiting visionaries, wily wayfinders, exemplary exiles, you and yours, and zero-emission zealots. For a full A to Z of the people who make our metropolises rattle along like a well-designed subway and occasionally screech to halt like one too, listen to The Urbanist, the show about the cities we live in, presented by me, Andrew Tuck. It premieres every Thursday at 1900 London time here on Monocle 24. That's The Urbanist, the show for people who know that the countryside is for softies and that it doesn't matter if you can't find two words beginning with X.
Sichuan was one of China's poorest provinces until investment from Beijing and abroad brought boom time to its capital. Monocle's video journalist Gabriel Li paid a visit to Chengdu to gauge the progress.
Here the changes are radical. This has become a much more international city, and every day you see it growing more and more. This is the new market inside of China, which is it's not a market itself, it's a continent. Foreign companies that want to sell something in China, now they're trying to come here. And you can see they're coming here.
Chengdu, the new China, in the films menu on Monocle.com.
And welcome back to Midori House here on Monocle 24. This week, the Dutch Safety Board made public an incident which took place on a Transavia flight in September of last year. During the flight by the low-cost Air France KLM subsidiary, a pilot was locked out of the cockpit while his co-pilot slept. This time, there was no tragedy, but it's not the first incident where an over-reliance on technologies meant for what it meant for security and safety, and of course the problems surrounding it. But is our dependency on tech, from avionics to proximity warning systems, really that problematic? Well, joining us on the line for more on this is Murdo Morrison, editor of Flight International magazine. Hello, Murdo.
Hi there.
We've touched on this topic many times before, but here is, on one side, it's a bit of a comical incident, but then again, not great that, of course, the co-pilot was asleep. Now, it seems rather straightforward. Was it just a case of this pilot forgetting the door code?
Yeah, we don't know too many details of this because this was posted on the airline's own website. And the airlines are very good now. The whole industry is very good at coming clean about these things, and it's all to do with a culture of openness and transparency. And the whole ethos is about not so much blaming pilots when things go wrong, but learning from mistakes and building all these into a kind of building all these lessons into a sort of safety culture that the industry learns from. So we don't know too much about the details of this yet.
One thing that, as I was saying earlier, that we've discussed before, in a world of automation, people not necessarily become flabby, though we do see enough pilots who are on the flabby side, but their skills become a little bit more numbed. And I guess there's been this call, hasn't there, for more retraining, more refresher courses. And it's amazing. I was talking to some CEOs from some airlines recently, and they said that's the problem. They even find a lot of pilots now, they want to transfer into, let's say, the cargo division because they actually get to fly more.
Yeah, no, I mean, I've heard this. I mean, it's a controversial issue, and it's been, it was something that impacted on the Air France crash in the South Atlantic, for example, that pilots, highly trained, skilled pilots could have sat there and not been aware, being so sort of fixated on what was going on in the cockpit and reading the instruments and not being aware of what was going on outside the aircraft. And it seems incredible that almost that sort of intuition didn't sort of apply in these circumstances, and they were sort of unaware of their external circumstances. And modern planes are pretty much designed to fly themselves. And this is the difficulty, this is the challenge for pilots. They're highly trained, they go through, intensive refresher courses all the time, and they know how to operate this technology, but it's a psychological thing as much as anything else. They're sitting there in a cockpit, there are two of them, the plane pretty much flies itself unless something goes wrong, and they have to have that 100% concentration the whole time. It's almost that sort of, it's almost like soldiers in the First World War, that sort of 99% monotony and that 1% where you have to be absolutely switched on. When something goes wrong, you have to know how to deal with that in seconds and in real time, and that's really the psychological challenge for modern day pilots.
For the more lay listener or someone not so fixated on aviation, let's go back to the Transavia incident. Okay, yes, it becomes, you know, it goes public, it's out there, but does Boeing issue some type of alert, or is, you know, it's already out there on the ether, we're talking about it, and so yeah, anyone who's head of safety at any number of carriers will then, you know, post some type of alert in the network. What happens when there is, you know, this was quite, could have been quite a serious incident?
Yeah, in a situation like this, it would normally fall within the airline's own what are called standard operating procedures. All the many circumstances that can happen in a cockpit, they're not necessarily regulated by the Federal Aviation Administration or one of the regulators. So the airline will tend to have a procedure for, you know, what happens when one of the crew needs to pop to the loo during a flight. And, you know, nature calls, that does happen from time to time. Now, some airlines, what they'll do is it sounds a bit bizarre, but the crew, pilot will swap with a cabin crew member who will sit in that seat. The cabin crew member isn't there to fly the aircraft, but is there just as a sort of, as a redundancy, as a backup in case the other pilot, God forbid, has a heart attack or falls asleep or whatever. They're there as a guard against that.
Mm.
So airlines will have all sorts of procedures for what happens when the pilots eat their meals. They tend to eat, you know, on long haul flights, they tend to eat different meals just in case one of them is contaminated or whatever, and they don't both fall ill. So airlines will have all sorts of SOPs to guard against for these sort of situations.
Mm. I was looking at the ticker on Bloomberg just now. More notes about the 787 paths not leading necessarily to the parts of the wiring that they thought, and you know, big question marks now around how long this aircraft is going to be on the ground. This is your patch, sir. Do you have sort of a board up at the office?
Well,
there must be some kind of pool running at flight.
Well, yes. I mean, it's nobody knows, which is the short answer. I mean, this has been, and we're all, even our more technical-minded reporters, are having to get very familiar with the battery chemistry and all very, very, very down in the weeds subjects that you know, we don't tend to write about in great detail most weeks.
Mm.
And you know, this is all coming down to the lithium ion batteries, which Boeing has rather controversially used on the 787. These are batteries which have sort of come into play in consumer technology over the last decade, but are still pretty new in aviation. Now, whether it's just a problem with the battery itself, whether it's a problem with the way that the Boeing is using the battery, whether it's something to do with the interface between the battery and the whole electrical architecture on the 787, we don't really know. I mean, Boeing and the investigators, the authorities in the US and Japan are pretty much working around the clock, because every hour matters for Boeing. They're losing millions of dollars over this every day and every week.
Yeah, I mean, they had they just managed to squeak through with some decent results this week, but I can imagine that next quarter is not going to look quite so rosy. Just before we go, is there a way for Boeing to reverse engineer out of this? If they say, look, there's no solution with these batteries, could they go back to a system that you might find on the 777 or something else at this point?
Yes, I mean, it's possible. I mean, at the moment, the official line from Boeing is that they've made the right decision by going for lithium-ion batteries. But Boeing executives are sort of leaving a door open to being able to replace it. Now, it may not be a case of replacing the whole lithium-ion technology. It may just be a case of redesigning the battery so it looks a bit different. I mean, without getting into too many technicalities, there are ways that they could go without, you know, without completely going back to old tech batteries as they would see it.
Mm.
But it's you know, it's one that they are going to they're going to be looking at very, very closely in the next. Well, have been and will continue to do so over the next few days.
Mm. We're not going to get a date out of you. I don't think that plane's going to fly till June. Anyway, you heard it here first. Murdo Morrison, editor of Flight International magazine. Thanks. But I can see on the other side of the glass right now, both our Andrew Tuck and our foreign editor, Steve Bloomfield, are making their way into the studio for our week's review of news.
Vanuit London, dit is Monocle 24.
London으로부터 Monocle 24입니다.
De Londres. Essa é a Monaco 24.
Oi, London. This is Monaco 24.
Ot London, tu é Monaco 24.
Fra London, dette é Monaco 24.
From London, this is Londres.
Holanda.
London, London으로부터
Hong Kong.
Hong Kong.
Zurich.
London.
This is Monaco 24.
And you are listening to Midori House on Monocle 24, as I said just before we went to that lovely little sting. Andrew Tuck, our editor, is here. And our foreign editor, Steve Bloomfield, is here. He thought I said former foreign editor.
I got slightly worried.
I know.
So,
we're showing,
should I actually
you,
come
we're
in
showing you to another door. Okay, gentlemen, what stands out for you this week? Quite an extraordinary news day, but if we rewind a little bit further than the last few hours, Steve?
Two things. One is Israel. And it's airstrikes inside Syria, and that's obviously something that's going to be ongoing, or that part of the Syria crisis. But also Mali and Timbuktu, which, as we were saying before we went on air, it feels actually like it was quite a long time ago now, but this has all happened remarkably quickly.
Mm. You think it's a long time ago because it's, you know, for French forces, it's gone incredibly well.
It has. And I mean, I was talking to journalists in Bamako a week ago who were saying, well, look, I think it's going to be a long time before we're able to have a Timbuktu dateline, which is frankly what all journalists ever want, is a Timbuktu dateline.
Did you ever have a Timbuktu dateline in your...
No, I didn't.
Oh.
No, I did once suggest to Andrew I should go and do a story about the manuscripts.
But it's not a bad place for a former foreign editor, is it?
No.
I think you'd have a lovely
send
little
me to
bureau
Timbuktu.
There.
Well, it was probably like that Yemen story they got the visa for that never happened anyway.
We don't talk about that anymore. but it's remarkable how quickly the French forces were able to, you know, to get to Timbuktu. I think the interesting thing, as we come on, as we move on from this, are two things. One is, do the French force the Malians to actually negotiate with the Tuaregs, with this, you know, this secular group that have some serious legitimate political complaints? That's one thing. And also, where have these jihadists gone?
Mm.
Have they done what they did in Mogadishu in early 2006, when the Ethiopians, backed by the US, went in, drove them out, and they just melted away and then started an insurgency? So I don't think this is over by a long chalk.
Andrew?
Touching on that, but kind of moving on as well, I thought it was a week of popularity contests in a way. It was interesting for Hollande. You know, he'd been seen as, you know, this kind of dead-in-the-water president, unable to do anything right. Every single thing he did in his personal life or on the global stage went wrong. Suddenly his approval ratings are up. It's been what you'd call a good war for him.
Mm.
But the other extraordinary thing I just thought was worth noticing is the approval ratings for Hillary Clinton as she steps down. You know, 75% of
Americans... She looked good today.
She looks good. Yeah, it's amazing that she's dealt with so many tough issues, that she is globally admired, and she has an approval rating that no president could ever get to. Mm. And there's some kind of magic that's attached to her over the last couple of years. I think she's extraordinary.
There is, and all that is true. But when you're only dealing with foreign affairs, it's a lot easier to remain
look
that
at
popular.
I don't think that's true, because you look at the foreign ministers of most other countries. People don't even know who they are. They don't rate them.
I'm not saying she's clearly a star. But I'm saying because she hasn't been associated. We don't know what her view on.
She's had to deal with the fallout from Benghazi, and even those situations, they don't seem to attach to her. I think there's she's managed to kind of step above the fray somehow.
And I think it was quite interesting when she was, you know, in front of the hearing, and it was also the first time we really saw her kick off, which was quite something. And just given the way all of the various commentators and mouthpieces that represent American journalism, even then she, you know, there's enough chat, but she didn't get such a hard time even over over that, which I thought was kind of interesting to watch.
No, I mean, she's become incredibly popular. Everyone loves her. And it's fascinating to look at, you know, how her career has developed when, you know, in the early 90s, she was reviled by the right and got this terrible time for the media. Then she had a bit of a comeback when obviously Bill had his dalliances. And then she's, you know, you can trace this fantastic little sort of roller coaster.
What are you going to do on Monday, do you think?
What am I going to do?
No, not you. No one's interested. What's Hillary going to do on Monday?
Right. Oh, Hillary on Monday is going to do nothing. She's going to do absolutely nothing.
Right.
And I think she's going to quite enjoy that.
Yeah, she's probably very thrilled about the fact that she doesn't have to wear a pantsuit.
Yes, indeed.
Because we went to a very nice event at the Danish embassy in Washington, and she lived opposite, didn't she?
She did, absolutely. And she didn't show up, though.
No, but we did see the security. You know, they had the car running, the engine on, just in case at all times. Apparently, they never switched the car off.
Having said that, though, the security didn't look that... I mean, you could walk up to the front door.
They might have shot
you. Could almost do knock-door
exactly.
run.
They might have taken your head off.
But, well, yeah. You never know.
Head aside.
Popped in, said hello.
Gentlemen, it's been a very, very busy week. It's quiet upstairs right now, isn't it? What's happening upstairs right now, Andrew?
Not that quiet. They're completing the issue. There's quite a few pages still to be shoved out the door tonight.
Now, I'm glad all mine are done. That's the great news.
Your desk looks like a landslide.
It does. It's not good. Gentlemen, Andrew Tuck, our editor, Steve Bloomfield, our foreign editor, thank you very much. Have a very good weekend. I now see, I'm just going to just comment on what's happening around the other side of the glass, because I see that Bill Bingham, our newsreader, is heading towards the studio right now. He's going to give us the headlines in a moment. But coming up over the next 29 minutes here on the program, we'll get the latest on the protests in Cairo. We will review the new Libyan banknotes with our Sophie Grove. We're going to meet our neighbors in Zurich as well, people who are rather good with pies, amongst many, many other things. But first, Mr. Bill Bingham has just made it back into the studio. Headphones are going on. Here are the headlines.
A suicide bomber has attacked the US embassy in the Turkish capital, Ankara, killing one of the guards. The blast at a side entrance of the heavily guarded compound sent debris flying into the street. No one has claimed responsibility for the attack. The US ambassador to Turkey, Francis Ricciardoni, has described the security guard who died as a hero. Rescue workers are continuing to dig for survivors after an explosion ripped through several floors of a skyscraper in Mexico City. The explosion at the headquarters of the Mexican oil company Pemex killed 20 women and 12 men. More than 120 people have been injured. Thousands of opponents of Egyptian President Mohamed Morsi are staging new protests after the deadliest week of violence since he came to power. More than 60 people have been killed in the unrest. Germany's Foreign Minister Guido Westerwelle has confirmed he's to meet his Iranian counterpart Ali Akbar Salehi in Munich to discuss Iran's nuclear program. He said the two ministers will also discuss recent proposals by the US administration for direct talks between Washington and Tehran. Argentina's foreign minister has turned down a British Foreign Office invitation to meet members of the Falkland Islands government in London next week. Hector Timmerman rejected the offer, insisting the international community does not recognise a third party in the dispute. The island's legislative assembly have said they anticipate a full and frank exchange of views in such a meeting. And those are the latest headlines here on Monocle 24.
Thanks very much for that, Bill, and more from you at the top of the hour. You're listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24 with me, Tyler Brulé. It's now been 1 week since the start of the latest wave of unrest in Egypt. At least 60 Egyptians have died in clashes across the country, and protests continue again today in Cairo. Thousands took to the streets. Our contributor, Rebecca Collard, brings us this report from the Egyptian capital.
More chants, more marches, and likely more clashes. Egypt's opposition called for more protests today, and thousands have come to the streets. Through rare rains in Cairo, these people are marching towards the presidential palace. Once home to ousted President Hosni Mubarak, it now houses Egypt's first post-uprising president, Mohamed Morsi. Morsi and his Muslim Brotherhood party are now the object of Egypt's discontent. Mahmoud al-Shami is one of thousands marching today.
They chanting, this one is like freedom, freedom, freedom. And they saying like no beard, and you will not deceive me again with the beard, you will not deceive me with religion, and you will not deceive me with anything else. And this is like, oh, 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 oh. and we're going to remove Morsi like Mubarak.
And for Mahmoud, the march today is in defense of his revolution.
And we just that we made the revolution for justice. No, we didn't make the revolution for replacing Mubarak with Morsi. It's not going to happen. We just need justice and need the freedom.
Discontent with Morsi is growing in Egypt as he attempts to quell what is now 1 week of unrest in this country of over 85 million people. Over 60 people have died in this latest wave of violence, which started January 25th. Most of the deaths were in the canal city of Port Said, which Morsi put under curfew and emergency law, spurring more unrest. Karim Zafar says Morsi is responsible for these deaths.
He just did like Mubarak also. We have a lot of people killed in Port Said, in Suez, here also in Cairo. And for me, if we put Mubarak in jail now because we had some people that were killed 2 years ago, for me, Morsi did exactly the same thing. And we have also a lot of people that have been killed by the government of Morsi or by the regime of Morsi. And for me, Morsi has to be beside Mubarak in jail, not president of Egypt.
For Karim, Morsi does not represent the interests of Egyptians, but rather his Muslim Brotherhood party.
He's only a president for the Muslim Brotherhood. He doesn't represent all the Egyptian people. And unfortunately, President Morsi and his Muslim Brotherhood are big liars. They didn't respect any statement that they did. They didn't respect the promises that he made before the elections.
Some in the march towards the presidential palace hoist pictures of the former Egyptian president Abdel Nasser. Others hoist flags and signs of protest, all chant against Morsi and his government. President Morsi has only been in power since July, when the military council, which controlled Egypt since the fall of Mubarak, transferred him control in a grand but perhaps only symbolic ceremony. Since then, the unrest has continued. The economy has worsened, and the price of basic goods has increased. Mohamed Abdel Gindi came from where he now lives in London to protest against President Morsi.
But nothing really has changed. The prices is rising. All the economic analysis saying that we are going to have a serious economic problem very soon. And security, as you can see, there is no security on the streets.
Egypt's army chief has warned the country may be near collapse. And some, like Akram Ismail, now fear the military will take some power back in Egypt.
Now the military is returning back, in a sense, in the scene. Because the Muslim Brotherhood is not able to control the situation. There is a lot of... The movement is very strong. It's getting more violence. The people is very angry. And this, of course, will return back the military to have some roles. I'm against this, but this actually is the responsibility of Morsi.
After 2 years of revolution, most Egyptians would be unhappy to have yet another military dictatorship. But few seem able to propose a solution for this increasingly unstable country. For Monocle in Cairo, I'm Rebecca Collard.
And for more on that, we are joined on the line by Rebecca. Good evening.
Good evening, Tyler.
Tell us what is happening of a Friday night.
Okay, that march that I was following earlier eventually did reach the palace, along with some other protesters. And what we're seeing now is fairly violent clashes outside of the presidential palace. So there's been reports of Molotov cocktails and tear gas. And I saw one report of water cannons also outside the palace. So things are definitely becoming more tense and heating up there at the presidential palace of Mohamed Morsi.
Mm. How much has the face of the city changed? And it's remarkable because you look at the role that Cairo played as really a hub at, of course, the top end of Africa. And we've seen a number of stories about, of course, what's happened to tourism, flight loads. I mean, just, you know, really, you know, airlines cutting routes into Cairo. I mean, now with all of this, going beyond kicking off again, what is life on the street like for you, Rebecca?
Well, I mean, it's mainly this central area. Now, today we're seeing these clashes and these protests at the presidential palace, which is in Heliopolis, so it's in kind of a middle upper class neighborhood of Cairo where the presidential palace is. But most of the clashes and the protesting in recent days has been in this central area of downtown near Tahrir Square. So this is also the area where you have the Egyptian Museum and a lot of the nicer hotels. So I'm also staying just a little bit down the corniche from Tahrir Square, from the Semiramis Hotel, which I don't know if you saw was attacked a few days ago by thugs as protesters clashed with police directly in front of the hotel. So this is a hotel where a lot of tourists stay, and now we're seeing clashes and tear gas and rocks thrown outside of the hotel, and increasingly the security forces have built walls. So basically, I mean, this has been going on more than a year now, this construction of these walls that block off downtown. So for example, Garden City, the neighborhood where I'm staying, on one side we have the Corniche, on the other side we have Katsaraleni, which is like another main street, and that street is blocked. So now that street's going one way, and the Corniche is supposed to go one way, now it's going two ways, and basically all these efforts to kind of keep people out of this downtown core is creating a lot of congestion and definitely affecting the lives of people who want to do regular things in Cairo also.
Rebecca Collard in Cairo for us. Thanks very much for that. You're listening to Midori House. When we come back right after this, we're going to review Libya's new banknotes.
The Entrepreneurs is about the movers and shakers, the lone rangers, the innovators, the modern mercantile mavericks, and the venerable merchandisers. It's Monocle 24's weekly business show. Every week, we seek out the startups, the brands on the make, and the leaders of global business empires doing things differently.
Assume you don't know the answer. If you assume that, you have to start creating options for yourself.
From master cobblers to asset managers, from impresarios in the luxury yacht sector to tech startups shaking up Silicon Valley. Tune in on Wednesdays at 1900 hours London time, or download the show on Monocle 24's website.
That's The Entrepreneurs, premiering every Wednesday at 1900 hours UK time in association with Pictet.
The latest culinary trends, restaurants with the best food, the coziest cafes, and the makers behind them. The menu tells you all you need to know about the world of cuisine and drinks and the people who are doing things differently.
The end is very important, just as in a sad ending, you may feel sort of sad in a play. No, there's no such thing as a sad ending for a meal, but there is the idea of a resounding ending, like the coda of a last movement of a symphony.
From organic cuisine in Sao Paulo to the latest coffee trends in Helsinki, from the most adventurous speakeasy in New York to the best butchers in Sydney, tune in on Fridays at 1900 hours London time or download the shows from Monocle's website.
That's The Menu, premiering every Friday at 1900 hours UK time in association with Krug.
And welcome back to Midori House here on Monocle 24, 1843 in London, 1343 on the North American East Coast. Now, we should probably keep it a little bit Maghreb, a little bit Middle East. Why don't we have a song? This is Ya Habibi by Lebanon's Tufik Farouk. Tufik Farouk there with Ya Habibi, something lovely from the streets of Ashrafia. You're listening to Midori House. It's 1847 here in London. Well, no longer does a young Muammar Gaddafi smile out from the Libyan dinar. The Libyan Central Bank has unveiled the new look of the currency, doing away with imagery from the now fallen regime. Now, it's the leader of the anti-colonial resistance, Omar al-Mukhtar, who graces Libya's 10 dinar notes. Our senior editor, Sophie Grove, is here with a variety of possibilities that might soon be dispensed from bank machines.
I am.
In Tripoli.
There's some interesting candidates. One that we're not sure it's been confirmed, but there is a sort of jubilant scene from the revolution and sort of, you know, crowds and flags sort of representing the moment that they were liberated from Gaddafi, which seems appropriate, but it isn't very striking in terms of a sort of structural, compelling image for a note. And then there was a couple of other examples of, you know, architecture. One is an Italian lighthouse. But it really feels like the Libyans are missing a trick.
Slim pickings.
Yeah. Mm. I mean, the design isn't very riveting. It isn't different enough to the old notes.
No, I would imagine if I was going from one country to the next across the region that someone could have made a little bit more effort as I'm trying to sort of fumble my way to find, you know, the Libyan currency that I could sort of very easily confuse it with, you know, potentially, yeah, something from Lebanon. I could confuse it with my Jordanian notes. And it's for a country which, you know, has, you know, is in the midst of a rebirth, that they should be seizing some sense of modernism.
Exactly. It's really an interesting moment, and also the discussion around whether or not a currency can really, the design of a currency can really do something for your identity, do something for your morale as an economy and as a nation. And I argue that it can. I mean, I've got some beautiful examples of, for instance, the Swiss franc, colourful, tactile, abstract, really sort of wonderful, almost technical drawings, but then this layering of colour and shade, and wonderful people, Giacometti and Corbusier.
Yeah.
So obscure people on there. And when we were recently in Switzerland, it's such a joy to use those notes.
And also just because they're a range of sizes as well. But as you talked about also, you know, the colour too. We're talking about Switzerland, but the fact also that, you know, it is in French, it is in Italian, it is in German, and there's, yeah, it really sort of delights and sort of, you know, touches every coordination. I think it's quite odd as well that when you look at these proposed Libyan notes too, that there's not a stitch of wanting to be part of also the contemporary world, i.e. there's no English on there, which I, or at least, or any other languages for that matter. You're only seeing Arabic script.
It's interesting. I mean, it's a country riddled with divisions, and deciding whether or not it does want to be modern or it wants to be this Islamic state. And it could just seize upon the moment, even if they employed a graphic designer or an artist who could maybe do some industrial architectural drawings or some add some colour, add a tiny bit of flair. You know, who are the Libyans that they really feel are synonymous with their new identity, even if it was, you know, an allegorical face, somebody modern, somebody new. There isn't a daring streak in this. There's no creative streak in this. And it is a shame. I mean, you see, for instance, when the South Africans relaunched their currency following all of the many, many years of hardship, you know, they put these, you know, they've put the big five animals on, but the which is, sounds obvious and cliched, but actually the design is so beautiful. It gives a sense of a pride to every single person that uses one of those notes.
So in an absence of maybe contemporary figures who, you know, no matter what, are going to be sort of divisive somehow, you're voting for good engineering and architecture, contemporary, but also maybe through the ages as
exactly.
well.
Exactly. I mean, there's a wealth of Greek ruins in Libya, arguably some of the best in the world, if they haven't been completely looted during their troubles. But if you look at even, you know, Robert Kalina, who designed he's an Austrian, he designed the euro. Some of his drawings, they're completely inoffensive and bland, some people might say, but they are actually quite beautiful and little bit daring. When you get to the 100 euro note, which is the modernism genre of architecture, he's kind of doing these different styles of architecture, you see something that's really interesting. And you know, why can't they embrace something a bit new and just you know, give a bit of flair to the Libyan identity.
Yeah, and I'm actually maybe correction here if these end up doing it to the press, because I was probably looking at the reverse side. But we've got a variety of different notes which are proposed. I should say that these there are some which do have English script on them as well. But they do feel somewhat all of a different era, and again, certainly not in a good way.
It's funny, like, Rod, this is one of my favourite, and you know, for people who can't see it, which is everyone listening, it's the Dutch Guilder, which is by an absolutely wonderful designer, and it just has this sense of colour and celebration of Dutch culture, but it's very universal, and it uses that sense of abstract, you know, these technical drawings and the shade and colour. There's one that's the 50, which is actually a collector's item.
I mean, it's interesting not to wade in on a Euro debate, but then when you see this 10 guilder note, which is absolutely beautiful, you just think, God, you know, Euro, interesting and convenient sometimes, also highly divisive, but I would love to have that 10 guilder in my wallet.
Exactly, and that's the joy of design, like if you can actually use it, and it's you know, it's a utilitarian thing. The guy who did this, Uta Oksanar, is you know, he's a famous artist in that country, and people absolutely adore those notes even still.
Sophie Grove, our senior editor, thanks very much for that. You're listening to Midori House. Back in a moment. It's just 18:54 in London. It means we've got another 5 minutes left on this program. It's now time for this week's edition of Meet the Neighbours. Today, we're heading to our Zurich bureau and meeting Jacqueline Hodel from the Pie Shop. You'll find the Pie Shop hidden in an idyllic courtyard in Zurich's Kreis-Zechs neighbourhood, serving savoury pies and Cornish pasties, homemade apple pies, chocolate chip cookies, cupcakes and other delicious desserts, all homemade in the kitchen just behind the counter. Monica stopped by for lunch to talk to the woman behind the business.
My name is Jacqueline Hodel, and I am co-owner of the Pie Shop here in Zurich, where we are in business since nearly 7 years, making pies and selling pies. The initial idea was a book, which I once saw an advertisement in the newspaper about pies, and so I was interested in that, and I bought the book, and then at that time I had my nephew come over for lunch every day, and I just decided, let's try and cook something for him different, which he doesn't know. So we made a chicken pie and gave it to him, and thought, ooh, is he going to like it? And he loved it. So a few years later, when we wanted to open up the business, we thought, well, that could be something which, I mean, an idea we have to follow. And we did. So then we had some test dinners with friends and so on and so forth. And each time it was very positively accepted. So we thought, well, that's an idea we can follow. Our products are, of course, of British origin. And we have specialized on the savory pies. That means with vegetable, meat, and only vegetable. But we also have a whole range of sweet products, which we all make 100% here in our pie shop. In our savory range, the favorites are the chicken pie and the shepherd's pie. But of course, it depends. We also have a beef and Guinness pie, and we do a special pie for the locals, which is called the Zürich pie. That's, of course, with veal, mushrooms, and potatoes. Apple pie is one of the favorites. We do some very nice lemon pies, and since a few months, cheesecake, and a very nice recipe of chocolate mousse cake. So that's the sweet side. Of course, also chocolate chip cookies, which is more American, but also nice. We make the dough ourselves. We cook the fillings, and we use a fresh vegetable, fresh meat, and all the ingredients are, as far as we can, local. And you can also tell when you see the pie, it's not industrial. So we started in 2006, the pie shop here at Schaffhauserplatz, where we have our production. And we also have a small shop in front with a little bistro. We have a few tables and chairs. And since 2010, the viaduct opened up. We have a stall there, a stand or an island, whatever you can call it, where we just sell our pies. So they are produced here at Schaffhauserplatz, and daily we bring them down to the market hall, where we have a
point of selling.
The neighborhood here in Schaffhauserplatz is kind of a nice neighborhood because it's close to the center, but there's no big rush here. It's a neighborhood where people live, families live. Schaffhauserplatz has also a little center of working people. So it's a nice mixture of families, people who work, come and go. And it's very well connected with all the streetcars, buses, so you're easily reachable and can go wherever you want from here.
And that was Jacqueline Hodel from the Pie Shop in Zurich. Well, that music means that's all the time we have for today. Our producer was David Michon, researcher was Fernando Augusto Pacheco, and our studio manager is Alex Funnell. Next up is The Menu, where we'll be heading to Lyon to find out what went down at Bocuse d'Or, the international culinary contest dubbed the Olympics of Food.
You just make the good taste, the good food, perfect combination in the plates. It's important, the fish has to be perfect, the sauce has to be perfect, and the garnish just has to be unique.
And in 3 hours' time at 2200 here in London, Andrew Muller and Dominic Reynolds will be back with the Monocle Daily. And I can't really do the math right now, but I think it is in 15 hours. I'm going to be back with this week's edition of The Stack. That's at 1000 hours tomorrow morning in London. But till then, have a very good weekend and a very good night. Goodbye from London.